I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. A few years ago, I discovered that some milkweed had started growing in my backyard in a patch of lawn, and rather than being put out by weeds in the lawn, I was actually elated. And I've been propagating milkweed for a couple of years now, thinking that maybe I could do my little part for some butterflies, you know? I have seen enough maps that show the flyways for monarch butterflies that I actually dared to hope to see some show up in my own neighborhood one day if only I would grow the milkweed for them. Now, milkweed here where I live, it does grow in the foothills above my home along the Wasatch Mountain range of the Rocky Mountains. And I had always thought that monarchs were limited to certain migratory routes along the Pacific coast, but I've learned otherwise. There are multiple routes they take. And so I was actually delighted when I heard that some do venture inland from the Pacific across Nevada into the Great Basin of the Intermountain West, including places here in Utah. And of course, news of late is not good at all for monarchs near the Pacific. From year to year, we've watched a decline in their numbers that has been horrific to witness. So my little gesture of growing milkweed, maybe it's just a symbolic thing I'm doing, but I'm still holding out hope of seeing a monarch here in Utah. Others in Utah have seen them recently. There are online groups here that track them and count them as they come and go. Well, we have a humdinger of a monarch butterfly story for you now here on Constant Wonder. And that's because our next guest, who happens to be an amphibian researcher and an outdoor educator, is also very excited about monarchs. And she has followed this monarch story in a way that's very, well, let's just say she's not just followed the story. She has followed the butterflies themselves. And when I say followed them, I mean quite literally on a bicycle. Sarah Dykeman is with us. She's author of Bicycling with Butterflies, My 10,201-Mile Journey Following the Monarch Migration. She's actually the first person to ever trail the entire length of a monarch butterfly migration from the seat of a bicycle. And it's a delight to have her with us today. She's on the phone line. Sarah, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Hi, it's great to be here. Thanks.
Are you just the kind of person who will do something crazy like this? I mean, did you have to build yourself up and think it through and you know, develop a little courage for this, or did you just go?
Well, I have been doing trips like this, and I learned a long time ago that it is, you just have to go. And I'm not the most athletic or the most brave or any most of anything. I just set a date, and I start, and that's the hardest part, and that's what I did with my monarch trip.
So this was in the year 20, which year? And was it for a full year?
I started in March of 2017 in Michoacán, Mexico, and I finished at the end of November.
And where did
about
you finish?
Nine and a half months.
Did you finish back in Mexico again?
Yep. I started and finished at the same trees, just like the monarchs do.
Yeah, that takes some preparation, and I would imagine it takes some money too. I mean, did you pack light?
I did not pack light. On my bicycle, I have a kind of an old steel frame, beat up mountain bike, and I have on the front two bags that I fill with stuff. And on the back, I have two, they're called panniers that I made out of old kitty litter buckets. And they, too, are teeming with stuff. And the whole thing weighed quite a bit, but luckily I can go slow and steady. And with all that stuff on my bike, I was able to camp, which saves lots of money, and able to cook my own food, which saves lots of money. So in the end, it was more about having time than lots and lots of resources.
Was somebody following you along the way, or was this a solo journey?
Well, my joke is it wasn't solo because I was with millions of monarchs. But I was the only cyclist for most of the time.
Yeah, that's impressive. I mean, just the journey itself. But here's a problem that I can anticipate in your storytelling right now. It doesn't seem to me that the butterflies are going to follow the roads.
Yes, I have a story of the first day I am biking down the road, and it is just magnificent. There are literally monarchs streaming by at the exact speed. We're just following the road, and then the road curves, and the monarchs stream into the forest, and I sit there pleading with them, like, wait, monarchs, come back. And, of course, they don't listen. But my route sort of zigzagged, especially in the beginning when the monarchs stick to the mountains. But luckily by Texas, they really start spreading out. And as long as I was on a road in Texas in the spring, I was on the route of the migration.
So were you worried there as you were zigzagging that you would have lost their trail?
Oh, yeah. especially in the beginning, I thought, what if I don't see a single monarch? And this will be super embarrassing. And I didn't see a monarch for about 3 days after I left the overwintering grounds. And I remember that first monarch. I threw my bike on the ground. I started running after it. I snapped about 1,000 blurry photos for evidence. And I celebrated with what I tell kids is my monarch happy dance, which always slows cars down and gives me a wide berth.
Well, the thing is this. If you're doing this kind of a thing, you're going to hope that they stop at nighttime because you need to stop at nighttime. Do they stop and sleep at night?
Right, yeah. Monarchs don't fly when it's poor weather and at night. Now, I actually do love to bike at night because I love frogs, as you said. And so I'd always be like, yes, I'm making ground. I'm cheating. I'm going faster than them for a moment because in reality, I always tell people I'm faster than a caterpillar but slower than a butterfly.
What did you eat? I mean, you didn't pack at all. You must have stopped along the way for provisions.
Yeah, I try and carry about a day's worth of food. And honestly, I got pretty lazy. I made a lot of sandwiches. I have my classic salad sandwich where instead of having to use a bowl and do dishes, you stack a bunch of lettuce on bread with sunflower seeds and salad dressing, and you got yourself a salad and a sandwich. And luckily, about every few days, I found someone willing to take me in and give me a home-cooked meal. And, of course, I have lots of stories of getting ice cream from strangers all over. So I ate well.
How far into Mexico do you go? How far south do you go of the border in order for your starting place?
I started at the border of Michoacán and the state of Mexico. It took me about 3 weeks, about 1,000 miles of pedaling to reach the U.S.-Mexico border. So it's pretty far south.
And then the border crossing, you just go through a regular border station and show your passport. But that's not where the butterflies are going to be, so you're going to have to kind of chase them too.
I always looked in the sky every time I crossed a border. Monarchs don't cross borders. They cross rivers. They cross mountains. They have no idea that they're going from Mexico into the U.S., they are North American, and I think that's just a beautiful lesson they have to teach us. I always got strange looks at the border, but border agents were always super nice to me and had lots of questions just like everyone else.
Yeah. So by the time you get to the border, actually, that's the Rio Grande, and you're finding yourself with butterflies aplenty because you say they've dispersed by that point. They're not following a mountain range.
Exactly, yeah. They start to spread out when they hit the United States, and the females are looking for their special plant called milkweed, as you described, and that's where they're laying their eggs. And actually, about in Mexico is when that generation that left Mexico, they die, and it's then the next generation that continues the migration. So while I did a round trip, the monarchs actually don't do that. It takes 3 to 5 generations for them to complete that full journey.
The full journey, the round-trip journey, or a one-way trip north?
The full journey. So it takes about 3 generations, typically. It depends on weather, to get to Canada. And then there's going to be the generation born in the fall that flies back. And so I think of that every time I see a monarch in the fall. I think, wow, they are traveling to a place that they're the same place that their great-grandparents, or maybe even great-great-grandparents, were at the winter before. And, like, how amazing is that they can get there and find their way, having never been there and having no leader to get them there?
Yeah, this is really remarkable because when we think about monarch migration, how often have we heard about the migration without realizing it being a generational thing? I mean, this is, you say, 5 generations for the whole trip.
It really depends. So if it's a cold season, the eggs develop slower because they are cold-blooded animals. And if it's warm, they can actually get more generations in. So it really depends. But yeah, no one butterfly will make the whole trip.
So the flyway is very broad that you were following. Were you following any particular route that you knew where they would end up in Canada, or how did that work?
The vast majority of monarchs fly basically due north through the Midwest, kind of following the I-35 corridor. And that was sort of my northern route. But, of course, people all across North America, as you said, can find monarchs. And so I really wanted to also spread out. And one thing that is really important to me, and I just think really beautiful, is that I didn't see a monarch every day, but every person I saw along my trip, whether I was in that corridor or not, they are part of the migration. They are on the route of the migration, and they can plant milkweed and help.
Yeah, so you're into that.
I'm so into that, and I loved your story, and I think it's just a testimony to how we all can add up and we can all be part of the solution.
So you see a solution for this. I did share the doom and gloom part of this, that it's not looking good.
It's not. And, you know, people ask me all the time, what was the scariest or hardest part of your trip? And to me, it's just sitting with that information. But, of course, for me, if I sit with that, I do get sad and I get depressed, and it's not helpful. So the only way I figured out how to, like, wake up in the morning and celebrate the day is to, like, be part of the solution. And I don't know what the future holds, but I know that at least I can say I tried, and you can say that you tried. And when I was in the Midwest, often I just heard over and over again from people that said, you know, older people that said, when I was a kid, we used to see lots of monarchs. And I just always wanted to ask, what did you do? What did you do to help? And I want to gift the next generation at least my best try.
Do you have any information about the comparative perils for monarchs, if it's safer for them coming through Texas than it is coming up, say, through Baja California into California? Are there fewer numbers on the West Coast than there are in the inland?
There's basically two populations, and those populations do mix. So we do have monarchs crossing the Rocky Mountains, but in general, there's the western population that overwinter in California and the eastern population that overwinter in Mexico. In general, and they are two distinct populations. They're both facing severe declines. And in general, I think you can attribute those declines in large part to habitat loss and climate change.
Now, habitat loss, this involves, from what I understand from your book, this involves problems of deforestation in Mexico.
It's a problem everywhere. So I tell folks, if Mexico did everything right, if they conserved the forest, if they made sure that not one OML fir tree fell, the monarchs still couldn't make it if the United States and Canada did nothing. So this is another great teaching moment or lesson that the monarchs offer us, is that we are North American and we all have to work together to solve this. So in, like you said, in Mexico, it is an issue of protecting the OML fir forest, which is where the monarchs live. And in the United States, it's about protecting the prairie and offering monarchs milkweed, which is the only plant monarch caterpillars eat, and nectar plants, because they need a lot of nectar to make this migration.
What actually happens if the forests are not there? Is there greater predation? Are they hiding in the woods?
The story of the forest in Mexico is just so amazing to me. So the monarchs fly to these trees, and it happens to be about 10,000 feet above sea level, so it is the perfect temperature of not too hot and not too cold, as well as not too dry and not too humid. Now, the most important thing is to have the canopy of trees, which offer protection from the cold. The canopy acts like a blanket to kind of buffer the most extreme temperatures, and also acts as an umbrella to keep the monarchs dry when there are rain events or snow events. And it's just this really perfect, delicate balance. And when trees are cut, then that offers up a hole in the canopy for cold or rain to enter. And also, like you said, it helps. There are a few predators. There are a few birds that can eat monarchs in Mexico, and it makes it easier for them when there's more holes in the canopy.
Now, speaking of predators that might eat them, the bright orange color is supposed to alarm potential predators and shoo them off, I understand.
Exactly. The monarch orange color basically tells predators, hey, when I was a caterpillar, I ate milkweed. It helps give me this toxic protection. You can try and eat me, but you're not going to like it. So a lot of times you'll see a bite taken out of a wing of a monarch or some sort of like little nibble, and the monarchs can actually escape that. And in doing so, the whatever creature that ate that monarch remembers that, because often they'll throw up, it'll taste really bad, and so they'll see those bright orange monarchs and they'll say, oh, not going to do that again. a lot like humans. That's a story that I've heard with humans, too.
Not that we're biting monarch wings ever, but is it true then that the toxins from the milkweed go right into the butterfly itself?
Yeah, the caterpillars eat the milkweed, which they sequester in their body, and that is what gives them their toxic protection.
Yeah. Now, fascinating to me, this whole business of they fly at different elevations depending on whether they're going north or south.
Yeah, a lot of the determination on how high they're flying, it depends on the wind, and it also depends on what their end goal is. So when they're flying south in the fall, one of their goals is to get as fat as possible. They're one of the few migrants that leaves that begins their migration lighter than when they'll arrive. And their goal is to eat as much nectar as possible, so they're often all day flying near the ground, drinking as much nectar as possible, getting as fat as possible, because when they're hanging in those trees in Mexico, they try and be as inactive as possible, and they're not eating. They're actually just living off the fat reserves for most of the time, which also is a reason why it's so important that that forest is the right temperature, because if it's too warm, they become more active, they burn more calories, and they could actually starve.
Now, I'm guessing that if you're going to binge on nectar on the way down, it's really most important for that last generation, I would think, that are doing the final leg of this relay race.
Right, and that's why it's so important, especially in the fall migration in the corridor, to plant lots of nectar plants. It is one of the most important things that we can give the monarchs during that fall time.
We're going to come back and visit some more with Sarah Dykeman. She's author of Bicycling with Butterflies, My 10,201-Mile Journey Following the Monarch Migration. And we're going to talk about butter biking. Haven't said that yet, but to butter bike is, I guess, a new verb. Stay tuned. This is Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. Butter biking is our topic. We're visiting with Sarah Dykeman. She's author of Bicycling with Butterflies, My 10,201-Mile Journey Following the Monarch Migration. Sarah, did you coin butter biking? Was that just obvious from the start?
It was. I thought, I cannot fly like a butterfly, so why don't I try biking and I'll be a butter bike? And, of course, one of the things that I did on my trip is I talked to over 9,000 kids about butterflies and adventure and science. And the first thing I always say is, don't worry, my bike is not made of butter.
Did you arrange all of those presentations before you took off? Did you know you were going to be speaking to kids?
I knew I was going to be speaking to kids. That's something that's really important to me, to share my trip and just be a voice for the monarch, telling people their story. The way I arranged the presentations was really to go where the excitement was. So, like, I went to a school. I changed my route a little to go to a school in Oklahoma, in Nebraska, because a teacher said, "Hey, I have a school garden. Do you want to come visit it? You want to tell my kids about it?" And I said, "Of course." So I went where the excitement was, and it was always my favorite part of the trip.
I would imagine the children want to hear a happy story.
They do, and this is a happy story. Like, we could have easily lost the monarch before we even recognized where it went in the winter, and we didn't, and we were rallying, and it's a story of, like, working together and being connected, and it is a beautiful story, and my story especially is about people taking care of me every step of the way. The people that help the monarchs are helping me, and it is a really beautiful story.
Did your bike break down?
I had a few bicycle issues, but nothing that made me stop more than a few minutes or maybe a few hours at the most. My bike is a sturdy machine.
Yeah, how fast can you go on it to keep up with it? I don't even know how fast these monarchs move.
The monarchs go about the speed, a little faster than me or a little slower, kind of depending on the wind. And my speed, too, is directly affected by the wind. So if it's at my back, I can go fast all day. And if it's going into my face, I could creep along at 4 miles an hour. Really depends. And And my goal is always slow and steady. So I tried to go about 60 miles a day, and sometimes that took 6 hours, and sometimes it took more or less, depending.
Well, if the butterflies take off on their migration, is this kind of like a single wave? Are there multiple waves? Is there a vanguard? I mean, how you could lose them if you get too far behind, or are they just, is there like 3 weeks' worth of them that stretch over 1,000 miles?
More the latter. So in Mexico, in the end of February, the weather is warming up, and it's just like the most incredible thing to see of the sun will land on the monarch colonies, and they'll open their wings, and they'll kind of erupt into the sky. And on warm days, there'll be more orange in the sky than blue, and you can hear their wings flapping. And every day, starting usually in the beginning of March, some will leave the colonies to go get water. Lots will leave the colony to get water, but some won't return, and they'll just keep going. So it is a bit of a trickle. There's kind of a main push, but I was probably a little bit behind them, but I didn't notice. It wasn't enough for me to be disappointed or anything like that.
So every single day when you took off, you knew you had to cover how much ground?
My goal was about 60 miles.
Did you say 60 or 16?
60.
Yeah. And was that to keep ahead of them or to catch up with them?
That was just about to stay on pace. I knew I needed to be in Texas in the springtime, and in March and April, and I knew I needed to be up in Minnesota by summer, by June.
So Minnesota is where you ended?
I went through the Upper Peninsula and into southern Ontario. My furthest north position was in Sudbury, Ontario, where I stayed at a wonderful hosts and had a sauna and lots of home cooked meals.
And then did you just have to wait? I mean, they don't arrive and suddenly turn around and head back. I mean, you've got a month or two.
Right. I never stopped moving. The monarchs in the summer will become a little more resident, but I wanted to travel through as much of their range as possible. So I pushed east, and I actually went all the way to the East Coast and followed the East Coast down to New York City, where I saw a monarch, which was really inspirational.
New York City, a monarch?
I did. I saw monarch eggs in a park in Queens, and I saw a monarch male nectaring on a plant in Manhattan. So while all the other tourists are taking pictures of all the skyscrapers and buildings, I was running around taking pictures of a monarch.
So was your route, your return route, you didn't follow the same path? You went a different route altogether?
There was a little bit of crossover, but I, again, like I said, I wanted to visit as many places and tell my story to as many people as possible. So I went a little more east on my southern route.
And were there any places along your way where you lost them altogether and found none for maybe a day or two or three?
There were times when I didn't see one for a day or two. Sometimes that was because the weather was bad. I didn't necessarily worry about a day or two. I did worry when I spent a lot of time biking through cornfields, and there was corn all the way to the road, and there was nothing between the plant rows. And all the farmers told me, I used to see lots of monarchs, and now I don't see any. And that weighed on me. But then I would go to a city park, or I'd go to a garden, and immediately I'd find a monarch, which would kind of just re-energize me again. And it just proves if we give them space, if we share the planet with them, they will come and they will reward us with their story and their beauty.
Well, we've hit on part of the controversy here. As soon as you start talking about farming and the eradication of weeds is important to farmers, did you have conversations about this with any farmers you met?
I did, and you know, there are lots of farmers that are doing things differently, and there are plenty of ways to share. And there used to be actually common milkweed. It's one of my favorite. It has these really gorgeous purple blossoms, and it just smells so good. And common milkweed is a disturbance species. So actually when we started cultivating the prairie, it really thrived. And it thrived between the corn and on the edges of the fields. And it wasn't until we introduced broad-spectrum herbicides that we started losing that common milkweed. So all we just need to pause and go back and remember that we can share, and it is possible.
So you arrive back in Mexico at the end of this adventure, and I'm sure that was bittersweet.
It was. The last hill of the trip was the hardest. It's this cobblestone, maybe 4 miles, just a wall of a road. And I remember I waited till I got past the houses to start walking, and I had to push my bike a little bit. And I was on my bike taking a break, and I see a monarch go by. And I was a bit of a straggler, and so was she. And I just remember thinking, like, we did it. We made it. And it was wonderful. It was great, and I was happy for all the monarchs that made it. And I knew, though, that my trip wasn't really over. I knew I was going to write a book. I knew I was going to just keep telling the story and being part of the migration.
Have you had great support from people who care about monarch butterflies? I'm imagining that you might be something of an icon among them.
There's just an amazing network of people taking care of the monarchs, and they took care of me. I remember, I wasn't going to go to Southern Ontario, but I got an email from a woman who said, oh, you have to come, and I sensed her energy and her passion, and so I actually added about 1,000 miles to my route to make it happen. And from there, I had a presentation every day. I had a place to stay every day, and I remember the first, maybe the second house that I stayed at, the woman, my host, asked if I liked peanut butter, and I said, yeah, I like peanut butter. And there, it must have been a telephone, because they told everyone what I liked, and I had peanut butter every house, and they found out I liked ice cream, and I had ice cream at every house. And it's so wonderful, and it proves the power of our own efforts and our dedication. And the monarchs and I are both lucky to have such a dedicated team.
Well, Sarah Dykeman, such a pleasure to have a chance to visit with you. And what a story. What an adventure. I just can't even imagine doing this. You going to do something similar ever again?
I would actually like, when it's safe, to do another tour and keep talking about the monarch and keep getting my book and my story and the monarch story out there. So I think that's out there.
And maybe see a few amphibians along the way, too.
Oh, yeah. There's amphibians everywhere, and they're always a delight.
Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sarah Dykeman with us. She's author of Bicycling with Butterflies, My 10,201-Mile Journey Following the Monarch Migration. You notice she didn't round down. Do you have a favorite fruit? The medlar, the hedge apple, the durian? Most people don't bother with these exotic fruits. A poet praises difficult fruit on our show tomorrow. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.